was quite controversial in the beginning. Many people couldn't stand the rough sound of the King Oliver Creole Band and the Morton Band, and they preferred some of the more organized sounds of the semi-arranged New York and Chicago bands.
This is the musicians you're talking about.
Musicians and people from the Musicians Union who were friends too, the officials, and said, "You guys are killing yourself. It's the end of your career if you're going to play that old black music."
That's the voice of Bob Helm, a man we'll be hearing from during the next 2 hours in a pre-taped interview. This is Dave Radlauer in the KALW studios with Bob Helm. Bob has been playing reeds on the West Coast here since about the mid-1930s. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Dave.
It's great to have you here. I know a lot of people who are listening now have listened to you over the years, both on records and live, and are very appreciative of your music.
Well, you asked me to give you some sort of a description of the early years of the Yerba Buena jazz band, Dave.
Let's back up just a bit here. As a professional musician, you date back to the 1930s.
That's correct. 20s, actually.
Well, when did you first start playing?
Well, I started playing in a silent movie pit band in
1925.
And a small pit band in Dos Palos, a little central California, San Joaquin Valley town. Mm-hmm. And started playing alto. The leader of the band said, "Well, if you could get him to play tenor, I'll give him a job." So
you picked up tenor.
I had a job playing in the pit band. It was a little four-piece band playing between the reels. And this was a one-horse town. Not only a one-horse town, it was a one-projector town. So while he changed reels, the band would play a popular hit of the day.
Then you went from there on to other theater bands?
Nick Serpilio, the band leader, got some other jobs with bigger bands. So we had many jobs with bigger bands using three saxophones, and from that I got into the bigger 10-piece ballroom bands. And later on in Stockton, where in 1934 with the Walcott Valley Vagabonds, they auditioned for trombone players to play Tommy Dorsey's high parts, which were very popular at that time. And, that was the first time I met Turk. So he didn't join the band. He saved himself a horrible road tour by not doing that, too.
But you and Turk remained in contact, and then
later on we played in the band that followed the Fred Walcott band after it broke up. Played a lot of the jobs at Avon, and Turk was playing in that band, which is Merle Hard Band. That was in 1936.
What was the name of the band again? Merle?
Merle Howard. Well, eventually Merle Howard Band broke up also, and so Turk and I came to the Bay Area and played around in Oakland with various jobs, worked day jobs. We had met Lou, though, formerly in Reno, Lou and Gershbeck. Paul Lingle were playing with a band in Reno, and the ballroom had burned down and left them stranded, so the manager put them to work fixing the ballroom up so they could go to work again. And we played a one-nighter and happened to meet all the guys in the band. So later on, we renewed our acquaintance and came to San Francisco.
So you're talking about what the meeting of the individuals who later became the nucleus of the formation of the Yerba Buena Jazz Band?
Yes.
Now, we actually have a recording here, extant of you, with the band at the Suites Ballroom.
Lou had always been an arranger for, with the Carol Loeffner, Loeffner Harris Band. He did many arrangements for that band and other bands, and he was quite in demand, actually. And he could have gone into the studios in L.A. had he chosen to do that. he didn't like deadlines like that, so chose not to do it. And he liked the freedom of a looser band other than the stereotype hotel ballroom band. So Lou put together a big band and was able to get a job at Sweets, and we were in there a couple of engagements, and strangely enough, the Sweets brothers did a very good business on it, playing much more jazz than their usual bands played.
We've got Floating Down to Cottontown here.
That was one of the rousers, I think.
So that was a successful residency that went on for a couple of
years?
Yes,
it was, and except for this rehearsal, which you'll probably be playing pretty soon.
Yeah.
It got a little too exuberant for the Sweets brothers, and they had a live mic on the bandstand, and we were engaging in all kinds of fantasies and everything, and some of them alluded to them, and they took offense. And so we didn't work there very long after that.
But
it wasn't because the band wasn't drawing or successful. It was because it was a little too wild, I guess.
Got out of hand.
They used to tell us to cut it down about 11:30 and play some waltzes and slow moonbeam tunes.
Well, we've got a couple here from Sweets Ballroom that are by no means moonbeam tunes.
Well, there were the tunes that probably occasioned the Sweets brothers to say, hey, you guys knock it off and play some waltzes. So you'll probably, these are ones that probably gave rise to that.
¶¶
This is amazing. These have survived now. They've never been issued. And these were originally acetates recorded at the time, 38, 39?
Yes, they were recorded by one of the tenor saxophone players' new record cut machines, I believe it was, Henry Abramson. And he recorded this whole afternoon session. I think there were two rehearsal sessions, and he recorded the whole thing on his home recorder. And the acetates sat in Lou's chicken house up in Cotati for 35 years, I guess, and Ed Sprankle was given them by Lou, and he was able to transfer them to tape and remaster them. And out of the batch, this is what's left.
Ed will be happy to hear them. He's a regular listener to this program and a KALW subscriber.
So. He's quite a collector and an old friend.
Great. Yeah, he's sent me a few things. Also in these recordings, these acetates actually recorded at the Sweets Ballroom in 1938-39 of Lou Waters' big band. We've got Copenhagen. Any comment on that? Or Shake That Thing?
Well, they were in the same category as Floating Down to Cottontown. They were rip-roaring tunes. It was probably the best big band I ever played in. When it got to romping on one of these tunes, it was, strangely enough, it was unfamiliar music to most of the people who were used to big band swing type arrangements.
And what instrument were you playing, and what was the lineup of the band? Well,
it had a strange reed section, three tenor saxophones and three clarinet, doubling on clarinet. And three tenors, if you remember those days, was all the rage in the hotels. Three snoring tenors snoring away with one muted trumpet was practically the menu at every hotel in San Francisco, like Henry King's band and Eddie Duchin, and that was a standard instrumentation, three tenors, but we never played as three tenors. It was always two tenors and usually with the section, the brass section, of two trumpets, two trombones, and one clarinet wailing above it. And one trombone free to wail below it. So there's a nucleus in the center that's played the lead and block harmony, and then a wild trombone and a wild clarinet. So.
Well, let's give a listen to these very rare acetates from 1938 and 39, Lou Waters' big band at Sweets Ballroom in Oakland. Thank you.
At the end of that time, Lou decided that he didn't want to continue on with the big band. His reasons were that it was too confining to play the same way, the same tune, in the same manner every night, and as a consequence, everybody would suffer from the usual boredom that comes from playing stock arrangements and even very good specials nightly on a ballroom job like that, which was five nights a week, and that coupled with the popular hits of the day, he wanted to do away with that whole program, and so he decided to go with a smaller band with more freedom, and so out of that recruited some old friends, and that was the start of the Urbana band. Which started about 1938 after the end of the Sweet Spot Band. And the first rehearsal, I guess, was with some of the guys out of the band that I mentioned in Reno, Paul Lingle and Gersbach and Lou, of course, and then Trick and Bill Dart.
Bob's talking about Bill Dart, who played drums with the Yerba Buena Jazz Band, and discussing the very earliest years of the individuals who later formed that band. I'm Dave Radlauer with you for Jazz Rhythm on 91.7 Information Radio. We've been listening to some rare acetates of Lou Waters' Sweets Ballroom Big Band. These were originally cut on a home Recco cut type of machine, which used an acetate disc. And they sat in, as Bob said, they sat in Lou Waters' chicken house for many years and have finally been transferred and restored by Mr. Ed Sprankle. Bob, of course, played reeds, clarinet, and later soprano sax with the Yerba Buena Jazz Band and then Turk Murphy's Jazz Band. We'll hear Turk a little later. We'll hear from the Yerba Buena coming up shortly, and we'll hear from Bob's 1954 Riverside Roustabouts. In this next set, we'll also hear some, again, rare acetates of the Yerba Buena Jazz Band from 1939 rehearsals at the Hotel Mark Twain. Incidentally, in that last set, we heard Copenhagen, Shake That Thing, a little bit of Stardust, and let's see, we started with Floating Down to Cottontown, all from the Lou Waters Sweets Ballroom Big Band. In this next set, we'll hear Panama from the Hotel Mark Twain Yerba Buena Jazz Band rehearsals. Again, these are rare acetates from 1939, and several rare 78 performances by the Yerba Buena Band at Hambone Kelly's, recorded on the West Coast label, and from various and sundry sources. The band had this concept to play non-big band, non-swing, non-arranged tunes. So how did you go about doing it?
The general public, there weren't enough. The music was so unfamiliar to everybody in those days.
So how was that problem dealt with?
Well, we didn't have much of a problem when we played the date for the Jazz Society, because its members were mostly people who were acquainted with the music and the tunes. But when we started the full-time date at the Dawn Club, a lot of the people enjoyed the music, but they didn't know what tunes to ask for. So as a result, they were left there with the band on the bandstand trying to answer questions. What was that tune you guys played last week or last Tuesday? And so we devised a method of sort of dealing with this. We went to the program music like the string quartets and the little salon groups used. They passed out program music at the door of the five sets that we would play for the evening. And then Turk or Harry Mordecai had a flash card stand on the band and would flash the, instead of Foxtrot, Waltz, and Two-Step, they would be flashing the name of the number on the card that the band was playing. So we found that it helped a great deal. It helped so much that some people requested it, and when they moved to Hambo and Kelly's, he used the whole took mirror back at the front bar for the repertoire of the whole band library. So that made a big difference too.
So that was the education of the listeners. What about the education of the musicians themselves? Since you said this was somewhat unfamiliar to most players and listeners at this time.
Well, it was quite controversial in the beginning. Many people couldn't stand the rough sound of the King Oliver Creole Band and the Morton Band, and they preferred some of the more organized sounds of the semi-arranged New York and Chicago bands.
So, this is the musicians you're talking about.
Musicians and people from the Musicians Union who were friends, too, of the officials. And said, you guys are killing yourself. You'll see the end of your career if you're going to play that old black music.